Johnson. Europe needs more money to fight the debt crisis. That's the message today from the head of the International Monetary Fund. We'll hear from Christine Lagarde as she warns Germany that too much austerity will make the euro's problems even worse.
Germany has an interest in other members of the European Union, of the eurozone in particular, being in a better place.
The European Union slaps new sanctions on imports of Iranian oil.
There will be irritations, there will be a negative impact, and most importantly, there will be a negative psychological impact on the Iranian business community.
And Greece, names and shames, tax dodgers who owe billions.
The top debtor on the list owes 952 million euros.
Well, we'd like your views on anything you hear in the programme. You can leave them on the BBC business page on Facebook, and that is where we've been asking for your thoughts on whether Greece can track down its missing tax billions. You can only take austerity so far. That's the blunt view today from Christine Lagarde. The organisation she runs, the International Monetary Fund, acts as a lender of last resort for countries in economic distress. Speaking in Berlin, she had a clear message to reluctant German politicians. They must be prepared to spend more taxpayers' money to stop the debt crisis consuming countries like Italy and Spain. To do that, Ms. Lagarde said, Europe's bailout fund needs to be bigger. Well, the BBC's Steve Evans in Berlin has been talking to her, and he told me more about what she had to say.
Her message was very much about growth. She talked about a 1930s moment. Now, if you realise that there's a division at the moment between economists and politicians who are very much in favour of cutting public spending to get budgets back in line with reduced means, if you like, and those who say, we may call them Keynesians, who say that if you overimpose austerity in situations where a recession may be on the way, you make that recession more likely. And if you listen to Christine Lagarde speaking in Germany, she seemed to be saying that growth should not be forgotten. And if you overdid austerity, well, then you were going back to the 30s. That was the implication, that 1930s moment. And you have to realise that she came to Berlin to meet Chancellor Merkel. And Chancellor Merkel has been accused around the world of being overly wedded to austerity. Christine Lagarde, for example, said that fiscal policy isn't a morality play. In other words, there's no virtue or vice in a particular economic policy. So it was very much directed, I think, at the German view that there is a virtue in austerity. Here's what Christine Lagarde said.
It's difficult to actually, you know, prescribe for one specific country what Germany should do. It's much more complicated than that. Why? Because Germany is part of a market. Germany has an interest in other members of the European Union, of the Eurozone in particular, being in a better place, because those countries are Germany's clients. So it should certainly help in that respect, and it should strengthen its own growth model by balancing out between export, investment and consumption. I believe that with the employment situation in Germany, this is just going to happen.
You talk of a 1930s moment. How serious is it? Why do you say that? That's a big comparison.
I know it's a big comparison because I think that we're facing a big risk, a risk where countries start looking inward as opposed to outward. So my proposal, and maybe the comparison with the 30s is a bit excessive, but my proposal is that it's about rebuilding trust, it's about finding a cooperative solution that presents a comprehensive aspect to it, because it's a business for all countries, not just for the Eurozone, which would be in difficulty. It's a business for all regions of the world, and that's what really needs to come across. Otherwise, you know, between populism and protectionism, we're not heading for a nice 2012.
Well, that was the head of the International Monetary Fund, Christine Lagarde. So, Steve, a very direct message in a way to Berlin. How is that being received there?
Well, nobody's commented overtly. Nobody said, don't criticise us like that. But you do get a sense now that that message that if you do too much damage, or rather, if too much damage is caused by the medicine to the patients, that actually you, as the imposer of the medicine, may be damaged as well. That kind of realization, or that kind of acceptance of a message, is being more loudly voiced in Germany now.
That was the BBC's Steve Evans in Berlin. So how will Christine Lagarde's message be received 650 kilometres west of Berlin in Brussels? Let's find out from the BBC's Europe correspondent Chris Morris, who's there. Chris, will all of this be music to the ears of people like José Manuel Barroso, President of the European Commission, this idea that the bailout fund needs more firepower and that Germany needs to lay off the austerity a bit?
Yeah, I think it will, and it's not just Mr. Barroso, also governments in places like Italy and Spain. Mario Monti, the relatively new Italian Prime Minister who Germany respects, has been saying, look, we can only take so much pain before the political resentment it causes becomes counterproductive. So yes, on a political level, but also Christine Lagarde has clearly inserted herself into this debate, adding to a chorus of voices saying that the Eurozone needs to do more to back up itself. And that essentially means Germany needs to do more. But Germany has said it will not pay more than the 211 billion euros, which the German parliament has said it will pledge to the new permanent bailout mechanism in the EU, the European Stability Mechanism. She seems to be saying, look, if you think extra help is going to come from the IMF, that probably isn't going to happen, because countries outside Europe, like the US, other countries in Asia, are sceptical about that. And it's clear that she's essentially nudging Germany down that same path, saying there's plenty of money sloshing around within the Eurozone itself, and it's time you spent some of it or put some of it forward to try and save yourselves.
Right, and meanwhile, the prospect of an unplanned, unnegotiated debt default in Greece remains a pretty real one, and these tense negotiations between the Greek government and its creditors are still going on. Not much sign of progress.
No, but you know, it's been a hallmark of the Greek crisis for well over a year now that deadlines come and go and catastrophe doesn't quite strike. So we were told that a deal with the banks on a voluntary write down of debt absolutely had to be achieved by last Friday. It wasn't, and it still hasn't been. And now it may not be finalised until a week today, when EU leaders gather here in Brussels for another summit. What's happening today is that while the sort of technical debate still goes on in Athens, Eurozone finance ministers are meeting right now, and I think discussing whether the outlines of the deal will actually ensure that Greek debt becomes sustainable. In other words, will it be brought down to a level which gives Greece some hope of actually paying it off? What the EU wants is that Greek debt should come down to about 120% of GDP by the end of the decade, from about 160% of GDP now. In other words, even in 8 years' time, still an awful lot of debt. But I think if the EU judges that the deal on the table doesn't even achieve that, then they will go back and press those private bondholders for more.
Chris Morris in Brussels, thanks very much indeed. Well, international creditors aren't the only ones with a role to play in helping Greece back on the road to recovery. The country also has a real problem getting to grips with tax evaders. Now, the Greek government has published the names of more than 4,000 major tax dodgers. Between them, they owe the equivalent of $19 billion. Athens hopes this new name and shame approach will persuade them to pay up. Nick Malkoutsis is deputy editor of the English edition of the Greek newspaper Katerimerini in the capital. I asked him what sort of people were on the list.
Well, it's as you can imagine, it's a whole range of people. There are some names that will be known to Greeks, but probably not household names around the world. We have, for instance, the owner of what was once one of Greece's largest insurance firms, which has since gone bust. We've got the former chairman of PAOK Football Club, one of Greece's biggest teams, based in Thessaloniki, northern Greece. We've got a businessman who was involved in Greece's biggest ever political and financial scandal in the 1980s. And we've got an aging, popular Greek singer who's on the list as well.
And I understand that some of these are obviously big earners. 40 of the people on the list owe over 100 million euro each. Can that be right?
Looking at the list, the biggest debtor is almost at 1 billion euros, and there are actually, yes, you're right, there's quite a few, over 100 million euros. One thing to bear in mind is that this includes the penalties, the interest that the state adds to the original amount they owe. So, for instance, the top debtor on the list owes 952 million euros, although his actual amount started off at 561 million. So the rest is interest and penalties that have been added, and that's the case, obviously, for most of the people on the list. And the other thing to keep in mind is that a lot of the people, especially further down the list, are entrepreneurs, owners of companies that have since gone bankrupt or gone bust. So effectively, it's going to be very difficult for the authorities to collect the money that they owe.
That was the Greek journalist Nick Malkoutsis speaking to me from Athens. Well, you've been telling us if the Greek government's new name and shame tactic will work. Charles Damatis writes on our Facebook page, they can have an amnesty where persons who pay the taxes they owe by a certain date can avoid prosecution, but more severe penalties will be needed for bigger offenders. Gerard Pedrico says, name and shame tax evaders, why not? Of course, it's the right thing to do. Martin Berry thinks the British authorities ought to get involved. He writes, get the Rottweiler Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs in there to help collect the money. Sorted, says Martin. Do keep your thoughts coming to facebook.com/BBC Business. Well, it's the Chinese Year of the Dragon, and still to come on World Business Reports, what will it all mean for the world of finance?
A Dragon Year is a big water year, so we don't expect people will be very optimistic about the stock market.
That's all still to come. First, though, the businesses and people of Iran have been living with the effects of international sanctions for decades. Now, the European Union has moved to tighten the grip of those sanctions to try to persuade Iran to abandon its nuclear program. The EU today said it would ban all imports of Iranian crude oil by the middle of the year. This was how EU Vice President Baroness Ashton announced the move.
The pressure of sanctions is designed to try and make sure that Iran takes seriously our request to come to the table and meet. And you will know the importance we attach to them either coming back to talk about the issues we left on the table in Istanbul a year ago, or indeed to put forward their own proposals.
Baroness Ashton. So, how badly will these new EU sanctions on oil imports hurt Iran? I asked the oil analyst Simon Wardell.
Well, it will have an effect on Iran. It will have an impact on prices, but at the moment this isn't a comprehensive ban on Iranian exports. So while the EU won't be buying Iranian oil beyond the contracts they've already agreed to purchase, they won't actually see a global halt in Iranian oil purchases. But what Iran will have to do is find alternative buyers for the oil that was going to Europe, probably in Asia. It will actually probably mean they'll have to discount a little bit, find new buyers. It is a problem for them. There will probably be slightly lower exports for a while until they can find those new buyers, but ultimately they should be able to get the oil placed elsewhere.
But in the longer term, is it going to have trouble, Iran, finding new markets for its oil?
Until this is a global type of phenomenon, until something maybe is arranged through the United Nations, the big buyers of Iranian crude in China and in India are probably going to carry on buying this oil. As long as there are people in Asia who need crude and want to buy it, I think Iran will continue to export it at a similar level to what they're exporting now.
Yeah, and also Iran has powerful friends like Russia, for example. Russia's already condemned this action, so as long as the likes of Russia are there as a friend, do you think that will always minimise the impact of this kind of embargo?
Well, it does, because of course it makes it extremely difficult then to push something through the United Nations if Iran has supporters there who can block a more comprehensive sanctions program.
And I see that Iran's already threatened to close the main entry point to the Gulf for trade from the west. That's the Straits of Hormuz, hasn't it? I mean, do you think, ironically, that may end up having a bigger impact?
Well, certainly. I mean, if they actually followed through on the threat, it would. Iran has a difficult game to play here. If they were actually to shut the Strait of Hormuz, that would really have damaging consequences for China and India. I think most people are not expecting Iran to follow through on this threat to close the Strait of Hormuz.
And what lessons lessons do we learn from history about the impact of these kinds of oil embargoes? Obviously using oil as a lever to put pressure on international governments. Does history show that they were?
Well, I mean, the best example would probably be Iraq, which had comprehensive sanctions. They were not able to sell oil beyond the program administered by the United Nations, but of course they still did. And that was a much more comprehensive oil sanctions in place than what we're talking about with Iran. With something like oil, which is of course extremely valuable and very much in demand, you'll always be able to find buyers. There is always a black market available if needed.
That was Simon Wardell, an oil analyst at IHS Global Insight. Well, the Iranian businessman Bijan Hajipour is a strategic consultant who advises Western firms on the risks of trading with Iran. He told me what he believed the impact of these new oil sanctions would be.
I think, we should not forget this is not an embargo. This is a sanction by the European Union countries on the purchase of Iranian oil. That means that Iran will lose about 20% of its current customers for crude oil. There will be irritations, there will be a negative impact, and most importantly, there will be a negative psychological impact on the Iranian business community. But essentially, it would be mistaken to believe that Iran is going to basically sit back and say, well, okay, we lost 20% of our income. On top of that, Iran will benefit from the higher oil prices. I mean, oil prices are going to go higher as a result of this decision. So I think Iran will lose, certainly, but it's not going to be compelled to rethink its strategy in international policy.
Right. So as a tool of persuasion, this move is largely symbolic, is it?
I think it's symbolic. I think my analysis is that both sides, the Western countries as well as Iran, know that eventually they will have to sit at the negotiating table. And I think the real story here is that both sides are increasing their bargaining chips, preparing themselves for the day of negotiation or for the weeks of negotiations in the future, hopefully. As a bargaining chip, this will obviously be very useful. But as a tool, as you say, as a tool to persuade Iran to come back to the negotiating table, it will fail, certainly.
Iranian businessman Bijan Hajipour. Well, it's been a mixed picture for Western share markets so far today. Europe up, New York down. Let's get the very latest now from Jeremy Batson Carr at the stockbroker Charles Stanley. Jeremy, why don't we start with the oil price, because that always has an effect on share prices. And did that news on Iran have any impact on the price?
Well, yes, we saw a marked move up in the price of oil and the price of gas, in part Iran, in part Chesapeake Energy reducing production, largely in response to the build-up of supply, of course. So prices of oil rose, therefore the price of oil-related stocks rose, and particularly in the context of London, where oil and gas is a heavyweight sector, that will have been a contributory factor in what was another broad move up in stock prices.
Okay, and we've talked about this continued negotiations between Greece's creditors and the Greek government. Has that been hanging over the market? Because, again, you know, it wasn't a bad performance for shares in Europe's major markets today. They don't seem too concerned about that.
Seems like another classic case of buy the rumour, sell the fact. The markets are fairly convinced that ultimately an agreement will be struck between Greece and its creditors on this issue. That, of course, is something of a previous comment, but nonetheless, taken at face value, that's what the market is thinking. Bank stocks, of course, are hoping that this will follow through. Banks have been a very strong sector over the course of the year to date. I think it looks like being a case of potentially sell the facts when eventually we get news.
Okay, watch this space. Jeremy, thanks very much indeed. That was Jeremy Batson Carr there at the stockbroker Charles Stanley. Well, the 100 share index here in London finished up 0.9% at 5783. The Dow, though, in New York, that's down 0.4% at 12,673. Currencies, the euro is at $1.30.1 US cents. That's a rise for the euro of about just over 1 cent. And the pound's at $1.55.7. And that's a rise for sterling of 0.6 of a cent. You're listening to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Our top business headline this hour, the head of the International Monetary Fund, Christine Lagarde, has warned Germany that too much focus on austerity could make Europe's debt crisis worse. Now, BlackBerry squashed by Apple is a headline that's featured fairly regularly in the business pages in recent months. The company behind the mobile phone, once standard issue for business users everywhere, has been trounced lately, not just by Apple, but by handsets running on software from Google too. Well, now the two founders of Research in Motion, that's Jim Balsillie and Mike Lazaridis, have stepped down. They were the company's co-chief executives. The BBC's technology correspondent Rory Kethlin-Jones told me more.
If you ask many companies whether it was a good idea to have two people running it at the same time, they'd say no. But it has to be said that for nearly 20 years, it worked extremely well for Research in Motion. These were the people in there at the beginning, and they led the company to absolute mastery for a while of a whole new market, email on the move. But then when things got tough, questions began to ask over whether that was the best way to run a business.
So now Research in Motion has a new chief executive, Torsten Hines. I guess people must be asking, what can he do to turn this company around?
Absolutely. He's got a very difficult time ahead of him, I think, because they're way behind in the smartphone market. They're falling further and further behind the likes of Apple and, in particular, Google's Android. But he seemed incredibly confident.
I joined this company 4 years ago, and it was growing, but comparably it was still small in the wireless arena. We have taken this to total new heights, and that journey isn't over yet. If we continue doing well what we're doing, I see no problems of us being in the top three players worldwide in the next years in wireless.
Well, that was Torsten Hines, the new chief executive of Research in Motion. I understand, Rory, that you interviewed Mike Lazaridis, one of the co-chief executives and founder of Research in Motion, a year ago, and things didn't go too well in the interview.
It was a very strange interview. Most of it was about the new Playbook tablet. But as soon as I started asking about this security issue, they had a row with various Middle Eastern companies about what those countries saw as the excessive security of the BlackBerry system, then Mike Lazaridis sort of lost it.
That's just not fair, Rory. Because first of all, it's not a we have no security problems. We've got the most
secure
platform.
Why is that not a fair question to ask?
Well, because you said you implied that we have a security problem. We don't have a security problem.
Well, you have an issue, have a compromise.
No, we don't. We've just been singled out, right? Because we're so successful around the world. It's an iconic product.
Oh dear, that was Mike Lazaridis, who now, Rory, has departed as the co-chief executive of Research in Motion. I suppose the really big question now is whether this, well, it was quite a complacent attitude he had, whether that's something that's endemic in the culture of this company or whether, you know, a new guy at the top can stop that.
I think there was an enormous, you might call it complacency, you might call it self-confidence and justified self-confidence. It was in the later stages, it was their ability to react to a complete change in the market where they were left wanting. And I think investors will be asking whether the new man, he's the right man to really change things in a hurry.
That was Rory Kethlin-Jones. Now, celebrations continue around the world welcoming the Chinese New Year of the Dragon. American billionaire investor Warren Buffett has appeared on Chinese state television with his New Year wishes. The arch-capitalist and so-called Sage of Omaha is well respected in communist China for his financial success. Your country has accomplished amazing things, he said, and the best is yet to come. Then he broke into song.
Dinah, won't you go? Dinah, won't you blow? Dinah, won't you blow your horn, your horn? Dinah, won't you blow? Dinah, won't you blow? Dinah, won't you blow your horn?
Shishi. Warren Buffett there on, I think, a ukulele. But whilst good wishes from billionaires are one thing, our Hong Kong reporter Juliana Liu has been finding out how auspicious the dragon is likely to be for the global economy.
When it comes to making money in the stock market, it's fair to say that many investors here in South China pay attention not just to the bottom line or revenue forecasts. They also listen carefully to predictions made by well-known feng shui masters who look into the heavens and the ancient Chinese calendar to make their astrological projections. Now, one such master is Raymond Low here in Hong Kong. I asked him what the Year of the Dragon holds in store for the volatile global markets.
The dragon is a big water element. and water is not helping the stock market, because in the five element system, fire is optimism, fire is happiness, and it will help people to gain confidence about the economy. Then the opposite is water. So that's why in 2008, we have the year of the rat, which is the big water animal, which caused the financial tsunami. And then the coming year, dragon year, is a big water year. So we don't expect people will be very optimistic about the stock market. But still, we have the seasonal effects, like summer time, the stock market will be stronger. So therefore, from February to about July, it will be okay. But from August onward, when we arrive in autumn, the water element gets strong, then people will be afraid. That means the stock market has chance to go down again. But the strong fire comes in 2013. That is the year of the snake that will help the recovery.
Well, we saw so much economic turmoil and uncertainty coming out of the Eurozone in 2011. More such uncertainty, the year of the dragon?
I think it's still most of the problem coming from that side of the world, because we do not see the Western Europe has very strong luck in the coming dragon year. But on the American side, hopefully they are starting to improve. So therefore, it could be the American economy could be a little bit helpful to change the global outlook. China is still strong. And Asia, we don't worry so much about stock, but just more about natural disaster or even virus.
That was the Feng Shui expert Raymond Lowe, ending that report by Juliana Liu. Well, that's all for this edition of World Business Report. Don't forget to head over to the BBC Business page. That's on Facebook, with your reaction to anything that we cover, especially that news of the crackdown on the Greek tax evaders. And there's a podcast of World Business Report always available on our website at bbcworldservice.com/business.